Esther 1, verses 4 through 9. When he, that is Ahasuerus, showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days, when these days were expired, the king made a feast to all the people that were present in Shusha in the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace, where were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple, to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law. None did compel. So the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vashti, the queen, made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, as I've noted before, is known to history as Xerxes I. And we see here that he, in some sense, epitomizes the kind of wickedness that we have in the ungodly rulers and kings that oppress the people of God from time to time. He stands, in fact, as an exemplar of evil, having, as I noted previously, a will that is in the command of the highest bidder, and that is literally in the hands of the highest bidder, as will appear in subsequent chapters. Now, like every great tyranny, every great kingdom that appeared in the visions in Daniel, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, this magistracy is established like Nimrod in rebellion. And as the Apostle John tells us in Revelation 13:2 of the later Roman power, that it has its power, seat, and great authority from the dragon, from the devil. So this is not a magistracy exercising a moral authority. This is not a power ordained of God in any positive sense. This is not a magistracy that is exercising moral authority. It's exercising a lawless authority. And in this, it shows itself to be a satanic counterfeit. Now, having returned from quashing a rebellion in Egypt, Xerxes, this is the third year of his reign, that is Ahasuerus, has decided to contemplate the next item on his agenda for world conquest. And that, we know from what Herodotus and other ancient historians tell us, was Greece. So, for this purpose, he's made this great feast, which is, properly understood, more of a drinking bout. Yes, there's food, but in all likelihood, the amount of wine that is going to be consumed will far exceed the amount of food. And he's called all of his princes and servants, those representing the great power now that was the Medo-Persian Empire, he's called them to this feast. Now, this is also a counterfeit of the wedding supper of the Lamb. So we need to keep in mind there's a lot of imagery going on here that's designed to remind you of other things, because there's a contest. Contest between Christ and Antichrist. Now, as I mentioned, from the profane histories, we are told that this great war council that is being called here was the council that was called previous to Xerxes or Ahasuerus's failed and very disastrous excursion into Greece. It's relatively well known in history that the Persians were quite accustomed to holding these kinds of councils, war councils, together with big feasts. So this isn't surprising. But as it will appear in a moment, the book of Esther, I think, is more searching and honest in its assessment of the purpose of this feast than would have been apparent perhaps even to those who participated. Now the place is Shushan, a palace, a city in Susa, a fortress palace wherein Ahasuerus had placed a throne, which according to the Jewish commentators was actually made to look a lot like the throne of Solomon. In fact, they say that Solomon's throne had carved animals that, like lions on the steps, that would speak to you as you walked up it. But that only Solomon could sit in this throne, and so Ahasuerus wasn't able to sit in that throne, so he had a counterfeit made, and the only people who could do it were in Shushan. And again, this is why our story takes place in Shushan and not in the capital of the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember, God moves a king to get him next to his prophet, Mordecai. He's moved the king. He's inconvenienced the king, not the servant of God. Regardless of whether or not this is a true story, it does point out that this story is told in the book of Esther, represents a clash of religions. As I say, it's a great war here between the kingdom of Persia and the kingdom of Messiah. Ultimately, the point is that the son of Solomon should be he who inherits the throne. Now, you should also keep in mind this, that the mention of the throne and coming back to the throne again and again represents legitimacy. That's what the throne represents, a right to rule according to God. Therefore, although there's nothing explicit in the text which would confirm the opinions of the Jews that this feast was called to celebrate what the Persians thought to be the failure of the Jews to return from captivity, as Jeremiah had predicted after 70 years, in fact, from the point of view of the people of God, it does have this effect being placed at the beginning of the book. Because these are the Jews that did not return from the exile. These are the Jews, it's written to the Jews and about the Jews, that did not go back under Ezra and Nehemiah to rebuild the city and the temple. Now keep in mind as well that a large point in this book is that the heathen often accomplish the will of God without being aware that they're doing so. These events are all ordered by providence for the deliverance of the people of God and for the benefit of the church. It's not, God isn't bending things to convenience the wicked. God isn't bending things for the benefit of his enemies. God bends things providentially for the convenience of his people and for the victory and the glory of his kingdom. So the great miracle of Esther is that all things really do work together for good for those who are the called, for the elect, for those who are the called according to God's purpose. There are no outward miracles, as I mentioned before. This is not a book filled with the parting of the Red Sea, and 10 very, very strange plagues supernaturally descending upon an oppressive people. This is God working on behalf of a people who are in exile, and they're in exile because of their sin. The book of Esther then speaks of the contest between Christ and the dragon. the victory that is foretold when the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our Lord and His Christ. That's where this really, I think, should be placed. It's a story of the political conquest of a nation, an empire. An empire that controlled, by all accounts, nearly half of the civilized, or what the Medo-Persians would have considered civilized world. It's a story of political conquest, not by might, not by power, but by the Spirit of the Lord. And yet, remember, that the Spirit of the Lord works not with observation. We don't see Him working, but He's there. Now, having told us then who, Ahasuerus, when, third year of his reign, where, Shushan the palace, he's told us where all of this unfolds, and now we begin to get a description of the various and sundry events that are going on. So in verse 4, we read, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even in 180 days. In Hebrew, the word when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom, when is actually just a single letter, a bet, attached to the word which means he showed. The meaning of the verse is actually that his showing is continuous with the time of the feast. So as long as the feast was kept, the showing or display of Ahasuerus was being maintained. And here is where Esther begins to give us, again, a glimpse of what is really motivating the people, and in particular the king, what God is using to move the king. The real reason for the Convention of States is very different from the point of view of the Bible from that which is according to profane history. According to profane history, those who are called are expected to participate in a war council. And it's very likely that at some level at least, even Ahasuerus himself thought of that as his primary purpose in calling this convention of the states. But the Word of God never even mentions what is very clearly held forth in the profane histories. The Word of God instead makes clear the underlying rationale. Ahasuerus, on the pretext of gaining their counsel, has decided to place all of his power and glory on display, and so before some of the most powerful courtiers in the world, he sets up a tremendous display of his riches. And in turn, this display will be made known by word of mouth into the far corners of the empire. Now, how great was all of this, this display? We don't know exactly what Ahasuerus had. But we do know this. Now, this is in around 483 B.C. In 331 B.C., about 150 years later, it's reported that when Alexander the Great captures the Persian city of Susa and Persepolis, that he retrieves well over 800 tons of gold alone. No wonder then the word that here is translated glorious can also mean dazzling, as in dazzling with splendor. the riches or the dazzling splendor of the glory of his kingdom. And undoubtedly amongst the riches of his glorious kingdom were, as the Jews have noted, much of the spoil garnered from the time of the captivity when the temple was spoiled of its precious furniture. The things on display would have been from all of these conquered, captured, dispersed peoples. And it would have included all of the things that they took from the temple. All the temple furniture. Remember all the gold, all the silver, all of the precious things that went into the temple. That would have been carried off. We know Nebuchadnezzar carried that off. So these things are all there. And they're all put on display. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty. In Hebrew, the clause here stands actually in sort of a parallel fashion to the first. The word honor that's used here is better understood as something precious. It means something more like treasure. And the word excellent that is used here is used elsewhere to describe the ornamentation of women or the ornamentation of jewelry. And so what it's doing by way of this parallelism is calling the great display of wealth literally something like this: the treasure of ornament of his greatness. In other words, this display represents the most precious adornments of his greatness. That's what he's conveying here. It's dazzling. It's a splendor. It was a display that was, by all accounts, unsurpassed at that time in antiquity. In fact, it seems quite probable that it includes all of the wealth of these conquered nations, again, including that of the Jews. And so, this display represents a sort of triumphalism over those who have been overrun by these Medes and Persians. So I think the Jews are themselves conclude from this place that there was a triumphalism involved. And while there is undoubtedly a triumphalism involved, and undoubtedly this would be to great psychological benefit for the king when he's assembling a council of war as a way of saying, look how much the empire has progressed, look at all of these conquered peoples and all of their things. From the point of view of the people of God, the only conquering that matters, and the only thing that really matters if we understand the special providence of God toward his people and his church, is the fact that it was a statement of the triumphalism over the Jews as well. And because they're the people of God, ultimately he's triumphing over the people of God. He may be masking it with 100 other nations. But the fact is, the real assault against the truth of God is that it includes the people of God. Now, Ahasuerus then is claiming bragging rights. And it's interesting that he's pictured here as, in a sense, swelling up with pride, just as he prepares what we know now to be his ill-fated plans against the Greeks. The plans to come out of this are going to be a disaster. He's not going to be back for several years. It's going to be, after this event at the feast, it's going to be the seventh year before the story picks up again. Where was he during that time? Well, I'll tell you now. In brief, he was over near Greece getting beat. And getting beat bad by the Greeks. With badly. They were very badly destroyed by the Greeks. Surely then pride cometh before a fall. And whereas, I think interestingly, the point of view of the pagans, they would remember the defeat at the hands of the Greeks. You know, Esther doesn't even mention that. Esther doesn't bother bringing that point up. Esther presents this instead as a setting of the stage for the fall of the Persian Empire before the coming of the Messianic Empire, or kingdom. What is it that leads to the fall of Persia? Time is limited. It cannot endure. It doesn't matter how great the display. Nations, empires like to put on big displays. They like to try to convince you that there is this continuity. You know, you're not going to live forever, but the empire will. And that's what this display, at least in part, is meant to convey. You're going to live forever in the empire. If you take the right side of history. Of course, the foolishness of all of this is what? They're not taking the right side in history. They're failing to understand what is the right side of history. They're heathens. They're pagans. So no matter how great its pretensions at this time, God will make them a weak and powerless people. And those who happen to be his people, who are weak and powerless, are ultimately going to triumph even more than the Greeks. And even in Esther's book, we see them triumphing in a way entirely unexpected. He showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even in 104. Now, to read the commentators, it's kind of funny on this because while there aren't a lot of commentators on this book, there are some. And many of them question the actual duration of the feast, even though we're told it was 180 days. Now, the Jews believe that many days here actually refers not to the 180 days, but rather to the length of days, to the longest days of the year, summer days. And that narrative that they have actually fits with the time that the king is most likely to be sitting in Shushan. It seems, rather, that the feast is extended for 180 days, which is half a year. Think about that, half a year, in order to allow for this vast display of wealth and honor. It's very doubtful that the military consultations that are going on here would occupy that much time. In fact, they probably occupied very little of that time. It would have constituted a great part of the splendor of a king such as Ahasuerus that he could afford to entertain such a vast number of princes and nobles over such a period of time, in order to make this dazzling display available to them. The rabbis have noted from a previous verse that there were likely six levels of guests in verse 3. First, his princes. Second, his servants. Third, power or the army of Persia. Fourth, the army or power of Media. Fifth, the nobles, or if you remember, I told you the word here is a word derived from the Persian, and it means the first men, those who were over the 127 provinces. And then the other princes or rulers over those provinces. Each order then would be a descending order of courtier. And thus, each month, according to the rabbis, would have been devoted to showing various treasures that were meant to command their devotional attention. In fact, they would say that each of these months was taken up in showing the things which would most impress those people during that month, that order. Now, in all of this, what I think we really see is this. There's a tendency of ornamentation to dazzle people with splendor. All of this ornamentation is designed to attract the eye. And this is exactly the problem, in fact, with so much ornamentation and why the Bible discourages women from ornamentation. Because all that it's designed to do is attract the eye, kind of like the forbidden fruit. And it lends itself to tempting people to do that which is contrary to the right. Because what ornamentation tends to do is give an impression that tends to subvert all sound judgment. You know, there's famous people that you see pictures of them with all of the makeup. They don't look like that when you wipe all of that off, but they wouldn't be nearly as impressive if they didn't look like that. They wouldn't catch your attention. They wouldn't be as able to subvert your judgment if you saw what they really looked like. So what Ahasuerus is doing here is this in a big social context. He's trying to subvert the judgment in some respects of all these people. And evidently, according to the profane histories, he does so because it would have been in his best interest had someone counseled him that now or in this manner or this with this number of people is not the way or the time or place to approach the Greeks. But all of this is meant to subvert that very judgment. And of course, it's all around a feast which centers on drinking to further subvert sound judgment. Verse 5. When these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present at Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. When those days were expired or fulfilled, there's been a discussion about whether or not these 7 days were the end of the previous feast. Was it after 173 days had ended, the last week of this 180-day feast? But the fact is this. The syntax in the Hebrew here indicates that this is something that occurs after the 180 days. So we're told that the 180 days were fulfilled or completed. The language here also, I think, of complete or fulfillment, that language confirms the notion that there was the real purpose here is to make some vast royal display of splendor for those who are in attendance. The idea is to dazzle them with all of the power that the empire has accumulated over the centuries. So, after 6 months, this affair has concluded. However, again, remember, this has been a period of drinking bouts. So you have people who've been drinking for 6 months straight. This is like a 6-month-long drinking party. Small wonder, then, that the military advice that came out of this proves disastrous. But when these days were fulfilled or completed, the king, we're told, made a feast. And this, again, is a different feast. There's a special party for a very different group of people. And presumably for a different purpose, but not really. He might think it's for a different purpose. It might appear on the outward glance that this has a different purpose. But the fact is, the purpose of the two are tied together, and that's why Esther mentions them both. You see, here's another display of royal power and authority. And again, this royal power and authority is going to come into conflict with a much higher power, royal power and authority. We're told that the king made this feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace. This then was a feast for those amongst the common people. Not that six levels of important courtiers, but these are people that are present in the palace. If we compare this with verse 9, it's actually very clear that these people that are included here are only men. Now these men, we're told, were found or discovered in this walled fortress city of Shushan. And these men are not the same as those who attended that great 180-day feast that would have been attended with wine being poured out day and night. The Jews believe that this passage, this clause in particular, referred to Jews who dwelt in Susa at that time, but were not really Persian citizens. And while that may go too far, it does call attention to something which is very likely the case, that there would have been many Jews in attendance at the second feast. Remember, comparatively few Jews returned under Cyrus to help with rebuilding Jerusalem, the city, the temple. Most of them, in fact, had to a greater or lesser degree assimilated themselves in the societies wherein they were exiled. They'd relinquished any strong external practices which might have called attention to their different identity. Most of the Jews you wouldn't know to be Jews by simply observing what they were saying or doing. They might have been observant, at least at some level, but it was just as hidden as God is in this book of Esther. So they would have gone to this feast. That's part of the problem here. That the people of God had become so like the world. They didn't really stand out like they should. And that's one of the things that will be corrected through the providence of God. And all the people who were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small. Now that term, great and small in Hebrew, it doesn't mean old or young. It's not talking about big or little. What it is indicating is that those who are called to the feast include anyone from lesser nobility, lesser social positions that is lesser than those who are already at the 180-day feast, all the way down to men who are of the least social stature in their society. If we understand that 180-day feast is a display of triumphalism, and a triumphalism, particularly from the point of view of the book of Esther, aimed at the Jews, the people of God, then it appears that after this triumphalism, this feast is actually staged in order to cause Israel to sin. And that's exactly what the Jews thought was going on. It doesn't matter whether or not Ahasuerus was consciously thinking this. Remember, he's just an axe in the hand of whoever wields it. And while he's in the grip of this empire, he's an axe in the hand of the devil. And ultimately, Satan really only cares about destroying the church. And so we're told that this feast was 7 days. Now there's a problem. If you're a Jew, if you're one of God's people, you've been called to a feast that's going to last 7 days. The food might have been kosher, and the rabbis who comment on this assert that it was. That makes it a little easier. The drinking, of course, poses a temptation, especially when you're mixed together with a company of pagans. Drinking with pagans is seldom a good idea. But any Jews that attended this, they couldn't leave early without calling attention to their identity and raising questions about their loyalty to the king. Why is that a problem? It's called the last 7 days, and that means at some point they're going to have to break the Sabbath. And if we remember that one of the reasons why they were taken into captivity and put in exile in the first instance is that 70 years had been appointed, at least in part, because of the Sabbath breaking of the Jews. And it's alluded to in 2 Chronicles 36:21, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, that's that 70 years he predicts, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbath, for as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. That's 70 years. And that, by the way, that was itself a fulfillment of that covenantal curse warned of in Moses' law. Leviticus 26, beginning verse 33. And I will scatter you among the heathen, and will draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate, and your cities waste. Then shall the land enjoy her Sabbaths, as long as it lieth desolate, and ye be in your enemy's land. Even then shall the land rest and enjoy her Sabbaths. As long as it lieth desolate, it shall rest, because it did not rest in your Sabbaths when you dwelt upon it. So, if Israel could not be made to sin in any other way than through deceit, if it could be made to sin, if they could be made to sin over the very issue that brought them into captivity, there would be a further triumph. Their continued captivity could, with that, be assumed. And thus, whether knowingly or simply moved by a satanic impulse, what Ahasuerus has done here is presented a party that would sell the souls of men into prolonged slavery. People of God. The number 7 actually appears quite often throughout the book of Esther. And in Scripture it points to completeness. In this case, it would result, in the calculations of the wicked at least, in the continued or complete subjection of the people of God to themselves. So they're interested in this going on for 7 days. Furthermore, we're told that the 7 days, it was in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now this refers to that place in the palace itself, not the palace or fortress of the whole of Shushan, but that place or portion of the palace which is devoted solely to the king. The word that is translated court here is an Aramaic loan word, which is one more reason why we know Esther is written at a later period of time. But it appears to be a word derived originally from the Akkadian. And the Akkadian word, Gitan, that word refers to a small building. A building, Gitan, a building that, or an edifice that would have been in the interior of this fortress. It would have been like a large patio or pavilion that would have been surrounded by columns or pillars set apart. It was a large courtyard. And this courtyard stood, we know at least from some of the archaeological diggings that have been done around Susa, it would have stood in the front of the king's residence. And that makes sense. It was a usual place. It was a great courtyard. And surrounded by a garden containing trees and ornamental plants. It's not a farm, but it very definitely is filled with fruit trees. So the feast is placed then in a garden orchard that stood before the palace proper. And the courtyard itself, we're told, was paved. Where were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver ring to silver rings and pillars of marble. Beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. If you notice in the King James, where were are in italics, and so are the word hangings. It really just says as they're translating white, green, and blue. But that's not really necessarily accurate. First, I want to point out there's an unusual syntax in the Hebrew, which suggests what follows is actually quite a sight to behold. It's sort of an exclamation. He sort of pauses after talking about the length of this feast and being in the court of the garden of the king's palace, and he's talking about in the courtyard, white, green, and blue, or as we'll see, I think they've added a color that probably is not there. The King James does rightly, I think, take these to be colors of hangings or curtains, but it's probably best translated as white, fine linen. The second word in the Hebrew sentence is actually of Persian origin. It's karfas. And that refers to a linen, a fine linen among the Persians. And so it really means a white, fine linen. And the third word is actually a word that refers to purple woolen. Okay, so linen, the difference is linen is made of cotton, woolen is made of the hair of animals. And purple and white are royal colors. So these are large tapestries that are generally white and purple. And purple was a very expensive dye. It was extracted from the shells of mollusks. Remember Lydia, the maker of purple? That's what she was doing down by the seaside or by the water. She was collecting shells to make purple. And because it was such a labor-intensive thing, this was always a very expensive endeavor. And that's why purple is associated with kings, because only kings could really afford that color. So purple is a royal color. These fabrics, then, are, in fact, serving as vast awnings, which were supported as follows. We're told they were fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The vast fabrics of linen and woolen are suspended by a peculiar method. The court was surrounded by pillars of marble. Above this, there was a framework composed of silver rods. The rods were arranged in a way that would have been a somewhat elaborate trellis. So they would have been forming a trellis coming off of these pillars. And the fabrics then were fastened by cords of white linen and purple woolen. Now it's the linen and woolen that was used to fasten them were a little bit different. It's more like a purple yarn and it's a different kind of linen, but it's still a fine linen. According to Herodotus, the method of doing this, of forming this trellis and tying all of these fabrics over it was something that the Persians had adopted from the Medes. Persians, in fact, were very famous for appropriating aspects of other cultures that they conquered. Anything they liked, they would take. I think it's also notable here that both the metal, silver, and the pillars, marble, are white. The word for the marble that's used here is a word that means white marble, alabaster, and the metal, silver, when it's pure, it's a white metal. It's considered a white metal. So all of this is surrounding the courtyard and cast over it like a giant tent for the party. The beds, we're told, were of gold and silver. And this points to a custom of the Persians to recline at meals. So the beds upon which they recline, they're made altogether of gold and silver. The Jews said that the feet were of gold and the legs were of silver because you couldn't really see them when they were covered with cushions. But that's what they did. They were almost certainly bed frames which held cushions and fabrics draped over them. And they were there for the reclining, as I say, while they were eating. That, by the way, was not a custom among the Jews prior to sometime around the time of Amos. In Amos, we hear them talking about that lie upon beds of ivory and stretch themselves upon their couches and eat the lambs out of the flock and the calves out of the midst of the stall. Sometime around the prophet Amos, this begins to creep in. And later on, in the Gospels, when Christ and the disciples are reclining, the reason why John can recline into the bosom of Jesus is because they are, in fact, eating this method. They're reclining around a table. That was not the original Jewish way of eating. That was something that came to them because of all of their times in captivity. So the beds were gold and silver, and all of this, we're told, was upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. Actually, what this verse is saying, and there are reasons, some of these things were very hard to know exactly what is meant. In fact, there's one word here that we're still not sure exactly what it means. But the pavement, literally, the word pavement means a mosaic floor, was composed of precious stone, which was probably porphyry, which is a purplish crystalline stone, marble, that is alabaster, white marble, mother of pearl, and some fourth costly stone. If it's from the Assyrian, at least, it would reference a costly stone. It also could be from Arabic, which would mean it was a blackish stone, black in color. So there's a mosaic floor under all of this, and the idea is it's very costly. Now, the reason for all of this imagery is that what is being presented is reminiscent of the tabernacle. If we read in Exodus 26, moreover, thou shalt make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twined linen, blue and purple and scarlet, with cherubims of cunning work shalt thou make them. And then in verses 24 and 25, and they shall be coupled together beneath, they shall be coupled together above the head of it, unto one ring, thus shall it be for the boat, they shall be for the two corners. They shall be 8 boards in their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 sockets under one board and 2 sockets under another board. Additionally, we know the tabernacle used pillars for support in Exodus 26. We read of that. And the word for marble that's used here is used in the description of Solomon's temple in 2 Chronicles 29:2. So what we're given here is this. This feast is being portrayed for the Jews as a religious affair taking place in a heathen tabernacle or temple. And for those who are reading Esther, there's a foreshadowing of what is to come. Because, you see, God had punished the idolatry of the Jews by sending them into exile. And now, once more, the Jews who are going to participate are going to provoke the divinity. Now, verse 7, gave them drink in vessels of gold, vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. He gave him drink in vessels of gold. Look now, the attention is called to the central feature of this feast. Drink. The emphasis here is upon consumption of alcohol, but the royal splendor has to be studied. The word that's translated vessel usually refers to the containers in which the drink would be kept until it was poured in the actual goblets that were used for drinking. Nonetheless, it could refer to all of this. Whatever the case, we're told that all of them were made of gold. Now, the Jewish Midrash says that these were actually made of crystal, as costly as gold. Whatever the case is, whether some words are elided there or not, the point is this. There's a lot of wealth that's been put on display even in this seven-day feast. It's designed to get you to come. It's designed to get you to pay attention. The vessels being diverse from one another, the Persians are noted in the annals of history for their wide array of drinking vessels, and they prided themselves on the diversity. The feast, the drinking bout, is an occasion to put all of this on display, especially when you have that many people. The idea of the clause is actually this, that there were no two vessels or drinking cups that were alike. And that is further evidence of the great wealth of the king. He could actually afford to have every cup different, bejeweled differently, every cup designed differently. And we're told there was royal wine in abundance. And the wine that was served was that which pertained to the king himself. It was the wine of royalty. Perhaps it's the wine that was alluded to in Ezekiel, which was costly and we know was the usual drink of Persian kings in Ezekiel 27:18. Damascus was thy merchant in the multitude of the wares of thy making, for the multitude of all riches in the wine of Helbon and white wool. You see, for many of the people who were coming, the common people, the display of wealth might have been enough to entice them to come to the feast. But for others, this would probably be enough of a temptation to get them to attend. That they're going to get to taste the royal wine. They're going to get to drink that. The royal wine was not going to be, in fact, served in a restricted fashion, but it was going to be put on display and it was going to be given out quite liberally as an indication, again, of the status of the one who's throwing the drinking party, which is confirmed in the last clause of this verse, according to the state of the king. Now this is underscored, as I say, by this clause. It refers to the ability or generosity of the king. So the great quantity and the great quality was fit for a king. And even in this language, there's a subtle comparison being made here by the writer of Esther to Solomon. 1 Kings 10:13, and King Solomon gave unto the queen of Sheba all her desire, whatsoever she asked, beside that which Solomon gave her of his royal bounty. Here is a royal bounty. It's a royal bounty, and it's written this way to remind the Jews of the lost bounty. But it's held forth to them by Ahasuerus to entice them to sin publicly before the face of the king. You see, this is the problem. Everything could be interpreted in two different ways. The world intends one thing, but if we would only see it aright, we would understand the danger that's wrapped up in this. Verse 8, and the drinking was according to the law. None did compel. For so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. The word law, and the drinking was according to the law. The word law that's used here is used particularly in Esther, but it's also used in Ezra and some of the later Jewish writings. This is a law, this is a word, I should say, that is not like some of the other words that are used of law. This word law refers to a special law, a decree, a royal decree that was set for the party. Okay, so normally, the Persian custom at these kinds of parties was that the revelers at the party would drink at the command of the central toastmasters. So they would send people around, and you would drink at his command, and you would abstain at his command. So all the drinking was controlled, but everybody drank the same amount. For this seven-day festival, all that custom was set aside. Again, there's a likelihood here, I think, that this is also indicating that they were trying to entice the Jews. Because at each of these toasts, if they were being asked to drink to the health of the king and drink to the prosperity of the empire, no Jew could do that without knowingly committing idolatry. But they're trying to secretly entice them. And so they're told this is an open issue. You don't have to drink. There's no wishes or encouragements to arise from any external source. Drink as much or as little as you want. None did compel. There's no compulsion, more or less. In fact, the word there for compel has both positive and negative senses. All that was decreed to be done voluntarily then. It would remain free to everyone in attendance to remain sober, should they so desire. For so the king had appointed all the officers of his house. So this is a royal dispensation given to all the officers or commanders of the house, probably the toastmasters. And there would be no set times of drinking controlled by the king through his underlings. So he's not going to have that. He's relinquishing that. That's what that decree is, a royal decree. Now, the word that is translated appointed is actually another word used for elsewhere in the Bible for the laying of the foundation of the temple. It means to be established. There is then in this decree, again, a foundation being laid for the king's plan. But there's some ambiguity as to whether or not Ahasuerus is moved to do so consciously. You see, the foundation of the plot to destroy the people of God is going to be turned by a greater king to their salvation. And so all of this is laying the foundation. Whether or not Ahasuerus understands the foundation he's laying is immaterial. There is a foundation being laid here in this very command, this royal decree, that they should do according to every man's pleasure. And here's the lack of structure to the drinking party. Everybody's allowed to drink as much or as little as he pleased. Very different from the normal course at Persian parties. Nonetheless, each man is allowed to drink as much or as little. Now, it's been noted on this that amazingly, even in the absence of a rule, Ahasuerus requires a decree. So he has to decrees, there's a royal decree that there is no law. Which I think is a point that highlights the evil of what is going on here. Here is a king, a magistrate, who has usurped authority from God, the power to decree, and yet he decrees that there will be nothing. No decree. He decrees in a mindless manner. It's arbitrary. He's obsessed with power, but it's a mindless power. There's a willing without any end, but the accumulation and aggrandizement of power. It's being exercised to no purpose. It's just to say, I decree that there is no law. It's arbitrary power, and arbitrary power will be bent and turned to the ends and uses of others. So consider the great irony that's being set up here in the book of Esther. The great irony of a king who tries to please everyone by having no law. But in the end, he's turned to kill his wife because of a friend. And then, he's again turned to kill his friend because of his new wife. Because he has no fixed moral compass. He has no principles. He will go, he will sell that power to the highest bidder. He'll go with whatever it is that pleases him in the moment. That's arbitrary power. And that's really evil. Finally, in verse 9, also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Also Vashti the queen. In other words, at the same time the king made a feast for the men, Vashti, his queen, his wife, is also at work. Now her name means beautiful and is derived from a Persian word which signifies the best or beloved. So the idea, I think, here is, again, pointing out, just as the king had the best of all the worldly treasures, so with his wife. Point is, his heart is set on this world. He doesn't study the glory of God. He's not concerned about anything but self-aggrandizement, and that's not even with any real purpose other than power for the sake of power. She made a feast for the women. It was a custom among the Persians for the women to celebrate feasts at the same time as the men, but to do so separately. And in that, they put to shame the Christians of today, in particular, that they had enough sense to keep men and women separate in these kinds of occasions, especially when you have wine flowing. Here we see that Vashti is a legitimate queen, standing in the same relation to the women as did the king to the men. And she reflects the wickedness of her husband. She follows his example. And she too must then be accounted a seducer of the Jews, because she is seeking to lure them in to great luxury and vice. She wants to debauch them in luxury and vice. She wants to cause them to sin against God so that God will remove his protection. She throws this, makes this feast for women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So it's not in the same place as the party of the men, yet it is in the palace complex. Note that the royal house is said to be the property of the king. So the queen might be sinning in her portion of the palace, but the blame ultimately falls on the king. I think there's several things we can observe from these verses. First, wicked men act with respect to outward appearance and concern for temporal good. That's it. They engage themselves to do their own bidding, but God knoweth the hearts of men. Though some see only the outward display, God, in fact, discloses the secrets of the heart. And in the case of Ahasuerus, we see that he was very prideful and opulent in his rebellion against the Lord. It may not have been apparent to those around him. They might have been used to that. But to the Jews, it should have been apparent for what it was. Pride and rebellion against the Lord, oppression of the people of God, oppression of all the people under him. And all of this will serve the purposes of him who's making war against the wicked and overturning the ungodly. That's the point of the book of Esther. And notice the second feast, which is designed to encompass the common people. Notice how long that is. Much shorter than the duration of the first feast. In fact, it's probably only 7 days long because they had to make sure that they opened it up for Jews to violate the Sabbath day. And look what godless rulers do. First, they consume the wealth of the nations on themselves. Then, after they finished, why, they'll give leave for the people to enjoy what remains. But they don't even excuse themselves from that, do they? They're still there for that 7 days. In that, we see the economic and the social disparity of tyrannies. And look again. Look again and see the design of the second feast in its duration. As I say, it's just long enough to entrap the Jews that participate. 7 days. They want to make sure they get to a Sabbath. Now, in that, I think we can see that whether or not they think about it, the wicked, whether consciously or unconsciously, they're moved by either their own wicked desires or that diabolical spirit, the devil. And they take secret delight in tempting the people of God to sin. And that's not enough. We're told that this party takes place in a garden setting where it once seemed that evil had triumphed over good. Remember that story? A man fell from his first estate in a garden. But what's interesting is Esther is preparing us for the gospel, because from this garden, like that garden in the gospel, Gethsemane, redemption is ultimately going to issue forth as God overturns and overrules evil to serve his own purposes. We need to note that this is a spiritual, religious conflict. Now, the heathen might not see it that way. They might not get that connection, but the writer of Esther, who is likely, as I said previously, Mordecai, the writer of Esther clearly does get that point. The temptation then also takes place in a place that has been likened to the tabernacle or the temple. Now, the Jews would have rejected any overt attempt to cause them to commit idolatry. But look what they're doing now. Now, the idolatry is not being brought to them in terms which are clearly religious. Now, this idolatry is being hidden within the political system of Persia. If they can't get you to worship in their heathen temples, they'll get you to participate in their corrupt political system. That's what's happening here. They might not bow down to the idols of the Persians, but those who end up coming to this feast are at least going to offer them obeisance. And that's part of the problem. I think you should notice as well the connection here between drunkenness and the spiritual darkness being poured out. And in this, it's very much like the character of the harlot in Revelation 17:3. To offer the wine of her fornication to those who are being deceived by what she's doing. Consider as well the decree of the Persian king, which allowed men the freedom to bring themselves to whatever degree of drunkenness they wanted. Freedom of religion, right? Freedom of conscience, at least, liberty of conscience on this. Got some liberty of conscience going on. Why is it important that the king left this open? Well, you see, they knew that if they compelled, it probably wouldn't be accounted sin. You know, if somebody puts a knife in your hand and then grabs your hand and stabs someone with it, it's not the same as if you take up that knife and stab someone. It's not really a sin. What's done by compulsion is not sin. So the sinfulness is attached to the willingness. And if the Jews, if they can be made to provoke the wrath of God willingly, then the enemies of true religion are going to prevail in this case. Then they're going to overcome. Then they're going to keep them in subjection. So in this, the enemies of the people of God may think themselves to be cunning, but the fact is this, God in heaven is going to turn all of these actions together with all of their actions to serve his purposes. And what they're going to end up doing is what the king was hoping the Jews would do here. They're going to voluntarily fulfill the decree of a higher king. Finally, I think we can see that although wives ought to be joint heirs of grace with their husbands, as Peter says, among the heathen, women are not only occasions to sin, they're actually agents of encouraging more sin. And that's actually where we find Vashti in all of this. So in conclusion, just remember that each and every sin, each and every occasion of sin in the book of Esther is being turned to serve the decree of God. That none of this is left unchecked. And none of this, no matter how seemingly insignificant, none of this, if you have eyes to see, really is that insignificant. When Satan moves men to attack the church of God, he does so in ways that are meant to mock true religion. And if you're not really conversant in what constitutes true religion, you're going to be turned aside, just like the Jews went up to the feast. And may God keep us from that. Amen.